David Meach describes himself as an obsessed student of wolves. Since 1968, he's tracked and observed hundreds of wolves from the air. He maintained a captive colony for 10 years and studied their behavior, and he even raised wolves for pets. But in 1986, on an expedition in the high Arctic, hundreds of miles north of Hudson Bay, he finally scored the big one. He found a pack of wolves that let him observe them, and he discovered their den of pups. This was a triumph for Meach because it is very rare for wolves to allow humans to observe them in such close proximity. Meach returned to the Arctic den and continued his research in the summers of 1987 and 88. During part of each stay, he was accompanied by a photographer. For the remainder, he was alone. Meach has written a new book about his research called The Arctic Wolf. He is a wildlife research biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and heads two international groups dedicated to wolf research and preservation. In a 1970 book about wolves, Meach described the first time he got within 15 feet of a wolf. He wrote, "I snapped the camera, and the wolf cocked its head. Its countenance was like that of a big friendly dog. It was easy to believe I could have petted the beast. It inspired me to learn all I could about the animal that had such a calm and gentle look, yet earned its living by killing." I asked Meach if this image still motivates his research.
Yes, because it sort of identified the wolf as a bundle of contradictions. In looking so friendly and in acting so amiable to its pack mates, it gives one impression, and then when you see it killing an animal, it gives another impression. Of course, that's only an apparent contradiction because we all need to kill to eat in one sense or another, whether we do it ourselves or hire somebody else to do it. But apparently, it's a contradiction, and that really intrigued me.
Why else are you an obsessive student of wolves?
Because wolves live in social groups, and they have a very complex kind of social interaction that we still don't entirely understand, even after looking at it for about 30 years. The interactions of the adults to the other pack mates, to their pups, and to the yearlings and two-year-olds in the pack are highly complex. And as I say, until we went to Ellesmere Island, where we could actually live with a pack close up, it was very difficult to understand what these interactions were like.
I think to appreciate your accomplishments, we need to know how hard it is to have direct contact with wolves. Why has it been so hard for researchers who track wolves to actually really get close to them?
Well, wolves have been persecuted throughout their history in most of the areas of the world, and that has made them extremely secretive and shy and elusive. Therefore, all the techniques we've had in the past to study them have had to be indirect. By that, I mean you have to either be sitting in an airplane watching them 1,000 feet below, or catching them and putting radio collars on and listening to what they do on the basis of their radio signals, or if you're really lucky, sitting out on the tundra somewhere half a mile away with a spotting scope and observing them. But all the techniques we've used in the past have been very, very indirect.
My guest is wolf expert David Meach. Now, you didn't find the wolves. You say they found you. How did they find you?
Well, the first time was in April of 86, and we had landed at an airstrip by a weather station, and that's one of the outposts up in the high Arctic. And I looked around as I was entering one of the outbuildings to put away some camera gear, etc. I looked around, and the coming down a ridge just about 60, 70 feet away, I suddenly noticed these wolves. I couldn't believe it because they were so close to the buildings, actually. And they stood there and wondered what we were doing, I suppose, and then continued on down the ridge out onto the ice of this big fjord. And it was then that we began starting to get our camera gear back out and taking some pictures of them.
Now, the second time you saw the wolves, you lay on your belly and whined. Why did you make that sound?
Yeah, they were out by an iceberg, and I was photographing the iceberg, and I know that they had they liked to spend time out there because I saw their tracks right up on top of the iceberg. And so I was out there looking around when I rounded the bend and spotted them. And I got down on my belly, and since they hadn't run, I thought, well, these animals are somewhat approachable. Let's see how curious they are and what they would do if I called attention to myself in some way that wouldn't necessarily give them the idea I was a human. So I lay down and kind of crawled on the ice and whined. And sure enough, they did stop and got quite curious and started back towards me close enough so that I could get a few pictures of them.
If you wanted to make them think that you were something other than human, was there a kind of animal you were trying to approximate with your whine?
Well, the whine would be, I was trying to imitate another wolf. Necessarily have regarded me as such, but not knowing what I was and then perhaps hearing what sounded like another wolf, I thought it would at least arouse their curiosity, which it did.
Once you started spotting the wolves on a regular basis, you wanted to acclimate them to you so that they would be comfortable around you and allow you to get close. How do you do that?
Well, the one thing is that there are no trees up in the high Arctic. There are really no places to hide. And while we were around the wolves, say 70, 80, 90 feet from them, and they weren't running from us, the main thing you need to do is stay close to them without making them afraid. So, for example, when we did approach, and we approached on snowmobiles at times, and they didn't run away, well, then what we would do is just spend time moving back and forth around them, but not close enough so that they would be afraid of us, but not so far that they wouldn't have to contend with us either. So we just stayed at a reasonable distance and watched them very carefully until we could see that they were not really afraid of us, and then we would start moving a bit closer. And at any time, if they showed that they were shy, we'd back off. But if they remained as we approached them just a bit closer, and we would never head them head directly into them. That is, we would not head our snow machines directly at them, but rather we would run parallel with them very slowly, but gradually closing the distance between us and them, and working over periods of hours and hours and hours, sometimes far into the night, because as you know, at that time of year, it's 24 hours of daylight, so we could work day and night. Gradually heading closer to them, they just became acclimated to us to the point at which they wouldn't run from our machines, even when we were within just a few feet from them.
My guest is David Meach. He's an expert on wolves and has studied them in different parts of the world. His new book is called The Arctic Wolf. You found a den of pups, and you describe it as really like the high point of your life. What did the wolf den look like the first time you looked in?
Well, I didn't look into the den, actually. I had seven of them, of the adults. I didn't see any pups right away. I had seven of the adults surrounding me and quite excited. They were barking and had their mane up and all, and so I knew that I was intruding on their area, and so I didn't go up and look in then. What I did is just start walking back up the hill because I didn't want to disturb them any further. So I didn't really see the pups until the next day when I approached the den from a different direction.
And how did they look?
Well, they were there were six pups. They were out lying on the tundra. They were beige and asleep, actually. I had crawled over a ridge and just peered over and looked at them from a distance of about 200, perhaps 300 yards. And there were these six little beige bundles, is how I described them, all sleeping on the tundra around these seven white adults.
The first time you were looking in on the den, you were lying on your stomach. And a couple of the wolves spotted you doing that. Did they make you feel like a peeping Tom?
Yeah, in a way, I really felt out of place. I was clearly on their terrain, and the other thing was that I wasn't hidden at all, so that by the time they saw me, I was sort of lying in complete view of them. And in a sense, I felt like a fool because they could see me and all. But as long as they didn't run off, I guess I was quite content, even if I was a little embarrassed about their seeing me.
Well, one of the wolves led all the pups out of the den after you were spotted. But then as you were leaving, the pups were led back in. So I guess you felt you weren't really going to be perceived as a big threat.
That's right. I was worried at first. They led the pups, perhaps an eighth, maybe even a quarter of a mile away from the den, but then brought them back to it. So I realized then that they were getting used to me, even with the pups, and that I probably wasn't upsetting them.
After the wolves got acclimated with you, you were able to follow them and watch them on a kill. You watched the wolves kill a musk ox. How did you follow them? They travel pretty far each day, far away from the den.
Yeah, wolves do travel far because they have to hunt very widely in order to find prey that they can kill. And when I say widely, they cover sometimes 1,000 square miles. We had four-wheeled all-terrain vehicles that we would use to follow them. And believe it or not, they weren't the least bit concerned about these vehicles and allowed us to travel right with them wherever they went.
Was this the first time you had watched the wolves kill their prey?
No, I had watched wolves kill prey a number of times while I was in an aircraft. I've watched them kill moose, and I've watched them kill deer, and I've watched them chase caribou. But I had never been close to them while they were doing it when I was on the ground. And that's what was the big difference here.
What did you observe that you never knew before?
Well, one of the things that I was most interested in regarding how wolves kill their prey was whether the alpha animals, those are the top ranking or the leaders, the parents, let's say, of the rest of the pack. I wanted to see just whether all the members of the pack contributed equally to the kill, or whether indeed this was, as I thought, it was the parents doing the main part of it. Now, when you're in an aircraft and you're looking down on a pack of, say, 15 wolves killing a moose and swarming all over it, you can't tell one wolf from another. But since we knew each one of the wolves that we were living with in the high Arctic, we knew each one individually and could identify it. This allowed me to actually determine which ones were doing the killing and which were most active in the whole procedure. And I thought it probably would be the alphas, but I was able to confirm this here, and that was one of the main things I was interested in watching.
I know that you really liked to watch the wolves, and wolves, I suppose, when they're just in the den or, you know, when they're not on a kill, look pretty dog-like and have a very endearing expression sometimes on their face. What was your reaction watching them pretty up close eviscerate a musk ox and then walk away dripping with blood? Did it give you a different feeling about those wolves?
Well, perhaps it would have if I had seen it 30 years ago from close up, but I've studied wolves full-time for 30 years, and that means that I'm certainly quite aware of how they earn their living, and so watching them close up was not that big a shock to me. They certainly, of course, had to do a lot of biting of the animal and tearing at it, and several wolves at a time tearing from different directions and all of that, and there was a lot of blood. But I was philosophic about it. I knew that they had half dozen pups back at the den, and they had to feed them some way, and that the only way they could do it was by killing other animals. So being philosophic and trained in objectivity as a scientist, I could just sit there and be thrilled that I had a chance to watch something that goes on all over the world, either with wolves or with raptors or other kinds of carnivores that kill for a living. It goes on all over the world day in and day out. And I just happened to be here in this case watching it. And so my main attitude was how fortunate I was.
Were you able to follow the wolves back to the den and watch them feed their pups?
Yes, in fact, what I wanted to do was to get back there before they arrived. In other words, they spent a certain amount of time feeding on the kill and caching food and feeding and all. And I wanted to get back to the den while they were doing that so that I could watch when they returned and see how they fed the pups.
How do they feed the pups?
Well, two ways. They'll bring food back in their mouths and also in their stomach. And in this case, they were, in the last case where we watched them kill a muskox, they were 20 miles straight line distance from the pups, and they carried all of the food in their stomach. So that when they approach the pups, the pups, of course, know when the wolves, when the adults return, that they're going to have food. So the pups, being extremely hungry, mob the adults and sort of lick at their mouths. And this tends to trigger a response in the adults to regurgitate. And then the wolves gobble up all of the partially digested food.
This sounds pretty, you know, bizarre to humans to listen to, I think. But I guess since wolves can't, you know, mash the food for their young or cook it to make it tender, it's a pretty effective way of pre-digesting it for them.
Certainly, and in fact, it's really not that different from what a dog does to feed its puppies when it's real young.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk with you more about your observations of the wolves in the Arctic, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Dr. David Meach. After 28 years of studying wolves, Meach made the discovery of a lifetime in 1986. While on an expedition in the Arctic, he found a wolf den and was able to observe the pups up close. He tells the story in his new book, The Arctic Wolf. David Meach is joining us from KSJN in St. Paul. This is Fresh Air. David Meach is my guest, one of America's leading experts on wolves. The wolves one day started to eviscerate your tent. What did you do to try to distract them from their task?
Well, the time that I was watching them actually pull my sleeping bag out at one of the tent portholes, I happened to be at the den while they were down at my tent. But there were one or two adults and the pups left at the den, and so I didn't follow our usual procedure, which was to bark at the wolves. That's an alarm call and it or a threat, and it chases them off. I couldn't do that because I was so close to the den, and I didn't want to scare the ones that were at the den. So I didn't bark. Rather, I let out the highest and loudest hoot, sort of a "huh!" Type of noise as I could to carry the quarter mile that it had to carry, and still not scare the adults around the den. And it worked. They heard that, and since they clearly were kind of anxious while they were pulling my sleeping bag out, as soon as they heard that hoot, they quickly dropped the sleeping bag and all ran off for about 200 or 300 yards.
You've also learned how to howl, haven't you, to try to get some response from wolves?
Yes, howling is something we've done for many years, even in our own research, say in Minnesota, where when we want to find out if the wolves or the pups are at the den in the woods and we can't see them, we will howl from a distance of, say, a quarter of a mile away. And if we get a response, which we often do, then we know that the wolves are around the den. So, yeah, I am fairly practiced at howling like a wolf.
What does your howl sound like?
Well, it sounds like a wolf howl. it's fairly low pitched, as opposed to the pitch of a coyote howl, which is a lot of yips and very high pitched. Wolf howl is a very low, mournful, moan like, long drawn out sound.
You know, the sound of a wolf howling is considered to be a very eerie sound by a lot of people, and for urban people like myself who are never out in the wilderness to hear actual wolves, it's a sound associated with the legends of werewolves and with monster movies. When you were alone in the Arctic and you would hear the sound of wolves howling, did it ever give you a creepy feeling, or are you too much the scientist and too much too familiar and respectful, too familiar with and respectful of wolves to have ever felt frightened by their sounds?
Well, it's the latter. I certainly haven't ever felt frightened of a wolf howl. It's because I view it differently. I mean, I know what it is, and I just view it really no differently than any other animal sound in terms of my attitude towards it. It's always a thrilling sound, just simply because you know that you're fairly close to the animal when it's making that noise. But it's not anything that to me is scary, because the interpretation I put on it is a more objective one.
You've written a new book about studying this pack of wolves in the Arctic. It's called The Arctic Wolf. But you describe in the book your publicity dilemma, that when you discovered this pack of wolves, part of you really wanted to let everybody know about it so that you could share the results of your studies. But on the other hand, you knew if it became public that everybody would want to send their camera crews there and do a documentary. How have you resolved that?
Well, we resolved that particular issue by doing the documentary ourselves, and because we knew somebody would want to do it, and we decided that the best people to do it was ourselves. So we signed a contract with National Geographic, who incidentally had supported us on the trip, the original trips there for the magazine, and we then signed a contract with National Geographic Television to produce a documentary on the same subject. And we felt by doing it ourselves, we'd get it out of the way and sort of preempt the field, and that would minimize the chances of someone else coming up and wanting to do the same thing.
So you're not going to make public exactly where the den is?
No, certainly not. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to, and I think anyone can understand that. It's in the high Arctic, 1,000 miles north of Alaska, and that's about as far as I'm going to go with it.
Right. Okay. You've been there every summer since 1986. Are you going to go out again next summer?
Oh, certainly. I'll probably be going up to Ellesmere every summer for the rest of my life, I imagine.
Do you ever get too old for this? If you don't mind my bringing up your age, you're 51 now. I think most people at 51 would feel perhaps a little bit too old for the kind of extreme circumstances that you're subjected to alone in the wilderness in the high Arctic.
Oh, well, no, certainly I don't feel too old for it, and I don't see why I shouldn't be able to, barring some accident or severe illness, shouldn't be able to go up there for another 20 years.
How long at a time can you stay?
Well, I have a lot of duties elsewhere, and in order to go to the high Arctic, I actually have to take either annual leave or leave of absence without pay from my own job. And so I have these other responsibilities that I have to meet, and I really should get back to civilization every few weeks. So the longest I've stayed away has been about a month. I would like to spend several months up there at a time, but I usually go up for, say, 3 weeks or so and come back for a week or two and then go back up for another 3 or 4 weeks.
Now, a lot of that time you spend alone. What if something happens to you? What if you get sick or you know, forgive me for bringing this up, but have some kind of emergency? Do you have any way of staying in touch with anybody who could get you
help?
Well,
if I really felt that was a severe threat, there is one way I could communicate, and that is I could have what's called an emergency locator transmitter, which they have in every aircraft. And when the plane crashes, the beacon goes on automatically, and satellites pick up the emergency signal. And I could buy one of those and take it up with me. And then if I broke my leg or something, I could pull a string on it and turn it on, and some satellite would find me and send somebody up there. But I don't really feel that threatened. Generally, I try to take another person with me each time, and I've only spent a couple of weeks absolutely alone up there. Most of the time, I would have someone else with me, and my intention for the future is to have at least one person with me all the time up there.
In your book, you say that we humans judge wolves by our own standards. If they kill, they're bad. If they mate for life, that makes them better. If they kill and eat one of their own, then they're ghastly. When you're studying animals, do you try to not apply moral standards to their behavior?
Oh, certainly. I learned, 30 years ago not to do that. So that just goes without saying for any biologist, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Are the wolves endangered now?
Well, they're endangered in certain parts of the world. They're classified as endangered on the Federal Endangered Species List, for example, in Wisconsin. They're considered on the endangered species list in another category called threatened in Minnesota. They're endangered in one or two other places in the 48 states where they exist, and that's Montana, Idaho, and there's some wolves down in North Carolina that have just been reintroduced in the wild, and they're considered endangered. In Canada, however, where there's about 50,000 wolves, the population's in good stead, really.
You'll be going up to see this pack of wolves again next summer. Do you want to make more progress than you've already made in getting them acclimated to you and in getting close to them?
No, I don't need to make any more progress. They are so acclimated to me that even in the summer of 1987, one of the little pups that was only about 4 or 5 weeks old waddled up to me and untied my bootlace while the mother watched, and the mother was only a few feet away from me at the time. So they're acclimated well enough for me to do all of that. I really only need to continue that degree of acclimation, and I can do all of the studies that I want to.
What's the next study you want to do?
Well, I need to continue watching. It's not really a separate study. We do several things, several studies all at the same time, really. But one of the objectives is to try to learn why some individuals, some offspring of the parents, remain with the pack while others leave at the age of about a year or so, a year and a half or a year, and just why the ones that stay with the pack for longer are allowed to stay there, and how they, what their role is in the pack in association with the newborn pups and with the adults.
Has it gotten to the point where it's sometimes a relief to get away from people and to spend time alone in the high Arctic with wolves?
It's always been a relief to get away from people. That's just, I think a lot of people find that. That's why people go canoeing in the wilderness, why they go camping and vacationing, and at least a certain segment of the population finds that. And it's always, all my life, it's been a relief to get away from people, and this just allows me to get farther away than usual.
It sure does. Thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Dr. David Meach. His new book, The Arctic Wolf, is published by Voyager Press. Meach is a wildlife research biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.